Oh, but I'm sorry for the coffee you got last night. I must have waked you up.
Oh, no, I have these earplugs.
Oh, yeah, earplugs.
I know you're right.
It's good for you. Good for you.
Letter to the editor by Bhikshu Jnanaramita.
Bhikshu what?
Jnanaramita from Ceylon. In the July number, Dr. Krishna asked about the proper approach to the inquiry, who am I? It is interesting in that connection to recall how the Buddha showed his disciples the voidness of the five aggregates, the anatta, Lakhana Sutta says, what do you think, bhikkhus, is the form permanent or impermanent? It is impermanent, O Lord. And that which is impermanent, is it painful or joyful? Painful, O Lord. And should one consider of that which is painful, impermanent, and subject to change? This is mine, thus I am, this is myself. One should not, O Lord. The same is then repeated of feeling, perception, tendencies, consciousness. Editor, this illustrates beautifully the theoretical discarding of the impermanent. But you must remember that self-inquiry was taught by Bhagavan not as doctrine or theory, but as a spiritual exercise. Sulu others in July 1965 were mostly kudos.
Kudos.
You know, for the great publication. October. Okay. January. 56.
This cup is not safe for microwave. It burn your fingers, you know.
Ramana Sadhguru editorial. He is now as he was. To many he said, you are not the body. We see now that he was not the body. In his body, lifetime, and now, guidance came to all who turned to him, whether they could approach him physically or not. Now, as in his body's lifetime, it radiates with peculiar force from his ashram at the foot of Arunachala. People say I am leaving, he said, just before the body's death. Where can I go? I am here. Not I shall be here, but I am here. He is here in the eternal here and now. He is here in each one's heart. He is here also in his ashram at Tiruvannamalai. He inaugurated a new path independent of formal rites and initiation to suit the conditions of our age when true guidance is hard to find in any of the orthodox channels and when traditional forms of living do not fit into the pattern of life. It would have been a poor gift if it had been for his lifetime only. He is the guru now as he was. Those many who never saw him in the body find his guidance no less powerful than we who did. Therefore, it is not necessary for any successor to give initiation in his name. The initiation was silent and formless, as it still is. The guidance was straight to the heart, bypassing words and thought. Understanding is needed, and courage and devotion. The path is there, and the guide to lead and support you to the goal. How can he perform the act of guiding aspirants if he has become one with the universal being? Theorists ask. This is what upset Arpana Subramanya, because one of David Gaudin's videos said he has merged in the Brahman. You know, he's universal now. And, you know, we can pray to him, but we're praying to Brahman. I mean, Brahman guides, I guess. But he has no longer any influence like he did when he was in the body. And he's special. You know, or something. He said in one of his videos.
That was Arpana.
Yeah, she got upset and she called me. She said, you know, because everybody watches the videos and they like them and everything, but he... How can he perform the act of guiding aspirants if he has become one with the universal being? Theorists ask. He is not. He already was one with the universal being. Everyone is. It is only a question of realizing it. And he had realized that oneness before death already. He himself confirmed that there is no difference between realization before death and after. The self is what you are, whether Muslim or Christian, no less than Hindu. Therefore, he turns people towards the inwards, to the self, to the quest of the self, making no distinction between religions. Books and scriptures teach that the quest must be undertaken and the ego dissolved. Once this has been understood, why study them intermittently? Therefore, he did not speak often or unprompted on theory. Did Christ or Buddha? About practice he spoke gladly. Powers are useless, often an impediment. Any desire, even for powers that are considered higher, indicates that there is still someone who desires. It is that someone who is to be traced out and dissolved. Only for our sake the Guru appears outwardly. He is the self in the heart. But because the impure mind misinterprets messages, the instructions are received outwardly to be followed inwardly. So what is Ramana? When he joined in singing Ramana Sadguru, he pointed to his body and said, do you think this is Ramana? In the recess of the lotus-shaped heart of all, from Vishnu downwards, there shines the Absolute Consciousness, which is the same as Arunachala or Ramana. When the mind melts with love of him and reaches the inmost recesses of the heart, where he dwells as the beloved, the subtle eye of pure intellect opens and he reveals himself as pure consciousness. They sing that at the end of every Tamil Parayanam.
That's
the Bhagavan's verse. But how, it may be asked, is one to know that one has been taken up by Ramana Maharshi and become his disciple, now that he is no longer here in the body to confirm it? The same problem existed in his lifetime also. He very seldom confirmed in words, having given initiation. It was to be understood, and then also there were some who failed to understand. As I explained in my last editorial, the time for rigid formalism, whether of initiation or the path into which one is initiated, is past. The new trend required to meet the conditions of our times did not, as I pointed out there, begin with the Maharshi. He brought it to completion, but it started as far back as the 19th century. Sai Baba, who lived at the turn of the century, also gave no formal initiation. Sri Vahari Mahasya, who died in 1895, so simplified Kriya Yoga as to make it accessible to householders also, and even to non-Hindus. That's that Yogananda Paramahamsa.
She has a guru.
Oh, Lahiri? Okay.
This is Lahiri. In the Maharshi time, as now, his initiation came without ritual, whether through a potent, intense look, or in a dream, or some other way. Now and then, people just know that the Maharshi is their guru, that he has taken them up, and that grace flows to them from him. And what then? People who turn to the path require some method, some discipline, some technique. It has been sufficiently explained in the mountain path that not all the Maharshi disciples, even in his lifetime, followed the path of self-inquiry. In particular, readers who wish for confirmation of this are referred to the Maharshi in the Path of Devotion by A. Devaraj Mudaliar in our issue of October 1964, and A Chakra at Ramanashram by Krishna Bhikshu in that April 1965 issue. His grace supports his devotees on whatever path they follow, whether there be in it more of devotion or knowledge or action, whether fortified by ritual or not, whether within the framework of any religion or not. And if any change becomes advisable, if any forms or techniques or methods are outgrown and cease to be helpful, some indication will come. Guidance will not fail. Having said this, however, the opposite side of the medal also should be known. That is, that the method which Bhagavan always recommended in the first place, which he spoke of as the most simple and direct, and put first in all his teaching, was self-inquiry. It follows, therefore, that such of his devotees as can practice it should. Some people have got a false idea that self-inquiry is a coldly intellectual method. There is no such thing. Intellectual understanding may be helpful up to a point on one's quest, but it cannot be the quest. I am not this body. I am not the thoughts. May be a useful preliminary to the inquiry, but it cannot be the inquiry. The inquiry is not a mental investigation, such as a psychologist might indulge in. It is not a probing into the faculties, urges, memories, or tendencies of one's conscious or subconscious mind, but a quest of the pure I-ness or I-am-ness that lies behind all these. It consists of turning the mind inwards to the sense of being, the feeling of I am. Therefore, it is not verbal. Who am I is not a mantra. Its repetition might perhaps help to steady the mind in the early stages, but can be of little use really. One hint that Bhagavan gave was that consciousness should not be centered in the head, but in the spiritual heart at the right side of the chest, because it is not a question of thinking, but of feeling and being. That does not mean thinking about the spiritual heart or meditating on it. When you want to see, you don't think about your eyes, you just use them. So also with the heart. It is not necessary to locate it exactly any more than it is to locate your eyes in a mirror before you can see with them. What is wanted is to have the experience, not argue about it. This about the heart is only a hint, but a very useful one. A man is made up of acting, thinking, and being. Being underlies the other two because you can't act or think unless you first are. But it is usually so covered over by them that it is not perceived. It can be compared to a cinema screen and they to the pictures projected on it. It is the screen that supports the pictures, and yet it is so covered by them that it is not perceived. Only very rarely, for a flash, one is aware of just being and feels it as pure, spontaneous, causeless happiness. It is also pure, thought-free consciousness. The purpose of inquiry is to make one aware of being at will and for longer and longer periods. This means that although the term meditation is conventionally used for self-inquiry, it is not meditation as the dictionary defines it. Meditation requires an object, something to meditate on. Whereas in inquiry, there is only the subject. You are not looking for anything new, anything outside yourself, but simply concentrating on being, on yourself, on the pure I am or you of you. It is not thinking but suspending thoughts while retaining consciousness. Normally, when you stop thinking, you go to sleep. And when one first begins inquiry, the mind often does try to do so. An attack of overwhelming sleepiness comes over you. But as soon as you stop the inquiry and turn to some other occupation of the mind, it passes, thereby showing that it was not real tiredness, but just an instinctive resistance to thought-free consciousness. One simply has to fight it. Thoughts themselves are a far more persistent obstruction. They rush into the mind in an unending stream. You drive them out, and others slip in from behind. You think you are free from these, and before you notice, you are indulging in others. The only way is persistence, constant alertness, not to get carried away by thoughts, to see them aloofly, like clouds passing over a clear sky, and ask, "What is this thought? Who did it? Who did it come to me, but who am I?" And so you bring your mind back to inquiry. The mind is likened to a monkey, rushing from tree to tree, ever restless, never content to be still. It has to be checked from its restlessness and held firmly to inquiry. But it is not only the wandering nature of the mind and the unending succession of thoughts that is the obstruction. It is also the ego drive behind many of the thoughts. This gives them power and makes them far harder to dispel. You may convince yourself, doctrinally, that there is no ego, and have occasional brief glimpses of the being consciousness, which is unruffled happiness, when the ego is in fact absent. But you are drawn to this girl or want to impress this friend or dominate this group. You resent this criticism or feel slighted by this person. You feel insecure in your job, cling to your possessions, hanker after money and power. And all of these are affirmations of the ego, which you believe not to exist. So long as they exist, it does. If there is no ego, who can feel anger or desire, resentment or frustration? This means that inquiry is not merely a cold investigation, but a battle. Every path is, in every religion. The ego, or apparent ego, has to be destroyed. That is the one essential common to all of them. The only difference is how to do it. There are paths which set you attacking the various vices individually, lust, arrogance, and so on, and cultivating the opposing virtues, but self-inquiry is more direct. Such methods are like lopping the branches off a tree. So long as the roots and trunk remain fresh, ones will grow. Fresh ones will grow. Self-inquiry aims at uprooting the tree itself. If the ego is deprived of one outlet, say, if it is forced to celibacy, others will develop, say, gluttony or vanity. But if the ego itself is dissolved, the vices in which it found expression will collapse like deflated balloons. But it is constant warfare until the ego really is dissolved. This is what self-inquiry is aiming at. It does not teach one any more theory or doctrine. It is quite possible to know all the doctrine that is necessary before you start. Quote, simply that being is, and you are that, unquote. What it does after a certain amount of practice is to bring increasingly frequent and lengthy experience of pure timeless being, which is also pure awareness and unruffled happiness. This is not mental, and yet the mind is aware of it. It is not physical, and yet it is felt physically as a vibration or a waveless calm. Once awakened, it begins to appear spontaneously even when you are not meditating, or to subsist as an undercurrent to whatever you are doing, to the routine of life, while you are talking, even while thinking. This is important with regard to method. It explains why Bhagavan prefers his devotees to follow the quest in life and the life of the world. Sitting daily in meditation is useful, in most cases, indispensable, but it is not enough. So far as possible, fixed times should be set aside for it, since the mind accustoms itself to them, just as it does with physical functions like eating and sleeping, and responds more readily. For people who are bound by professional and domestic obligations, just after waking in the morning and before going to sleep at night are excellent times. But apart from that, Bhagavan would tell people to practice inquiry always, to ask themselves who is doing this, to engage in activity without the I am the doer illusion. Keeping up this attitude of mind throughout the day's activities is equivalent to remaining alert, to welcoming the sense of being whenever it comes. Constant alertness and remembering is necessary when not meditating, no less than concentration when remembering. At first, there will be frequent forgetting. That also has to be combated. The current of awareness has to be cultivated and fostered. It is very seldom that there is achievement without effort. This is the path that Bhagavan laid down. It is independent both of forms and doctrines. It requires no ritual. It can be followed invisibly by the housewife or shopkeeper, no less than the monk or yogi. The grace of Bhagavan is available to all who turn to him. But it is those who strive on this path that utilize it the most fully and the most wisely. It is an unfailing support and an inexhaustible treasure for them. How I came to the Maharshi. This is a lieutenant, but Karamchandani.
Karamchandani. DMO.
Karamchandani.
It's actually Chandani.
Lieutenant Colonel. Normally, as soon as I place my head on the pillow, I fall asleep. Doctor. Lieutenant Colonel.
Yeah. He was a district medical officer.
One night in February 1949 at Vellore, for no conscious reason, I could not sleep and kept tossing in bed. That was something very unusual. At 1 a.m., a telephone call came from Tiruvannamalai, a place 55 miles away, asking me to reach there by 8 a.m. As Bhagavan Ramana was very ill, having received the call, I fell sound asleep. I was a district medical officer of North Arcot then, and Tiruvannamalai was still within my jurisdiction. I reached Tiruvannamalai without any emotion. My only thought was that I was on a professional mission of attending on a patient.
Patient.
The sainthood of Bhagavan Ramana had no significance for me. I examined Bhagavan Ramana. He had cancer of the main nerve high up in the arm. I gave my prescription and returned to Vellore the same day. I had conducted my examination of Bhagavan Ramana in a strictly professional manner. I carried no spiritual feelings for him, nor did he speak a word with me. But he had directed a momentary gaze of grace at me, which kept stirring me deeply. Involuntarily, I felt a new vista of spiritual consciousness open up before me. That wondrous gaze of Bhagavan seemed to envelop me with an aura of bliss. The spiritual pull from him felt so irresistible that after a few days I myself arranged a visit to Tiruvannamalai just for the sake of having his darshan. I took my wife with me. We visited Bhagavan with a sense of curiosity and an indefinable sense of expectation. We made our obeisance and sat by his feet. He did not speak a word, nor did he speak. No speech seemed necessary. So surcharged with spirituality was he that his spirituality wafted out to us, completely enveloping us. Serenity seeped into us. Our minds attained a state of blissful, ecstatic meditation. The tumor that Bhagavan was bearing must have given him the most excruciating, nerve-wracking pain. Such writhing pain would make the toughest man wince and moan, but Bhagavan's face was serene, smiling, and radiant. All of a sudden, the disciple accidentally touched only the fringe of the thin bandage that was covering Bhagavan's tumor. Bhagavan gave an involuntary start. The disciple felt bewildered and mumbled, "Bhagavan, did I hurt you? It was only the fringe of the bandage that my hand touched." The Bhagavan smiled his benign smile and softly said, "You do not know the enormous weight as of a mountain that this fringe bears." The chant exclamation of Bhagavan indicated the severity of his pain, but his godly face did not bear the slightest sign of his agony. It reflected only joy and peace. He seemed to have switched off his mind from the body to the divine. The next occasion when I was summoned to Bhagavan's presence was when he had developed anuria. What is it?
Anuria. Has to do with the urine.
Yeah, I forget.
Yeah. You can't urinate or urinate all the time.
Loss of low micturation, I think. You know, you do not produce any urine, I think.
I now went to his ashram, not with the all-important feeling of a district medical officer going to visit a patient. I went in the spirit of a humble devotee going to serve a saint of colossal spiritual magnitude. My ministrations as a doctor were to be coupled with the devotion of a disciple. When I reached the ashram, I was told that for the past 24 hours, Bhagavan had not taken any food, not even a drop of water. But the disciples' implorations in this behalf had failed, and that in consequence the entire community was feeling most anxious. I was entreated to persuade Bhagavan to eat something. On examining Bhagavan, I found that it was imperative that he should take some fluid. But what if he refused my request too? Ordering him in my capacity as a doctor seemed to be out of the question. I felt like asking him as a boon to accept my prayer. I prayed inwardly and held a glass of buttermilk before him. He gazed at me for a second, took the buttermilk in shaking hands, and drank it. My joy knew no bounds. There were relief and jubilation all around. I was thanked profusely. But I felt infinitely grateful for Bhagavan, his overwhelming grace. He had heard my silent prayer and granted my boon. Wonderful was the spiritual acceleration I experienced in Bhagavan's holy presence. The next time I was called to him was at midnight. When I entered his room, four disciples were there. Bhagavan was saying something to them in Tamil. They told me that he was asking them to leave the room, but that they wanted to stay, as according to them, he was in a delirium. I persuaded them to go. Three of them went away. The fourth one stayed on. Bhagavan turned to him and whispered, "You are not going away because you feel that you love me more than the others." The disciple now knew that Bhagavan was not delirious. He bowed and went. I was left alone with Bhagavan. As usual, he did not speak with me. I was also silent. But the vibrations that emanated from him were celestial. His body must have been in terrific mortal pain, but his heavenly spirituality was unaffected by it. A rapturous thrill electrified my entire being. I ministered to his body, but I was hardly conscious that I was a district medical officer. I was conscious only of an intense desire to worship this illumined soul. I had learned that Bhagavan did not allow devotees to touch his feet, but I felt a deep urge within me not only to touch his blessed feet, but to press them lovingly. I took courage in both my hands and pressed them. The wonder of wonders, Bhagavan let me do so. His grace was abounding. I considered myself in the seventh heaven. I glorified those few minutes of my life. The next time I was summoned to him was about 3 hours after midnight. Pain must have been torturing his body. Still, he was sound asleep. Holy silence filled the room. It was the ambrosial hour of the dawn. I did not wish to disturb him. I sat quietly by his feet. Suddenly, he opened his eyes. His gracious gaze fell on me. He softly muttered, DMO, District Medical Officer. The peculiar tone in which he mentioned me indicated that I had been in his sacred thoughts and that he was expecting me. I felt myself blessed. I silently worshipped him. My whole being seemed to vibrate with ecstasy. At that time, I had been feeling restless about promotion to the rank of Major General, Surgeon General, which was legitimately due to me as the senior-most IMS officer in the province of Madras. Howsoever I tried to banish the idea of that coveted promotion from my mind, it loomed large before my mind's eye and marred my equanimity. Then I said to myself, why am I fretting unnecessarily? The next time I visit Bhagavan, I shall request him to grant me this promotion. When I visited the ashram again, I went before Bhagavan with my mind resolutely set on requesting him for that boon. But a marvel happened. As soon as I saw Bhagavan, my mind melted, the resolution evaporated, and I felt filled with a strange contentment. A request did formulate itself within me, but it was an entirely different request. I inwardly prayed, Bhagavan, free me from my craving for this promotion. I don't want anything mundane. Instead, grant me my soul's evolution. My prayer seemed to be instantly granted. Effulgent joy flooded the very depths of my being. I reverently bowed before Bhagavan, and he gazed at me benevolently. My last visit to Bhagavan was on the day he attained Nirvana. I have described it in the Saintly Galaxy, the book he wrote. You can never find that, right?
No. But it's in the Fragrant Petals, though.
No, I know, but there's a book. There's a book in Saintly Galaxy. You know, it's in the Golden Jubilee. You know, these Fragrant Petals are the reprint from the Golden Age. How, on visiting him, I found that his body would not last beyond that day. How I silently prayed that he might retain his body till I brought my wife from Vellore, as she had always been anxious to witness a great saint's last moments of life. How she brought oranges for him, how he would not accept any drink at all, how once again inwardly I implored him to drink the orange juice to save my wife from deep disappointment, how he accepted my unspoken prayer and asked for orange juice to the transcendental delight of my wife and myself, and how shortly afterwards, in utter tranquility, he passed on. That was a scene of great somber beauty. During my 2 months' contact with Bhagavan, I did not speak a single word with him. But what wonderful grace he poured into me through his benign, benevolent gaze. a peerless spiritual experience indeed.
So there's a typo in the beginning of the article. They said in February of 49 he got the call. The call was actually in February of 1950.
Wow.
Because 2.5 months only. His whole life is transformed into a half.
That's the most intimate thing I've heard of Bhagwan, or read, the most intimate story of him.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's it. Take this word away.
What's it called?
Here's a poem by Arthur Osborne. To feel, to know, to be the Christ within, can there then be love for Christ on earth? Walking like men, seen as a man is seen. Seek not to argue. Love is greater worth. Love makes men kin. With the beloved, such have I known, him of the lustrous eyes, him who so look, pierced to the heart, wherein the seed was sown, of wisdom deeper than in holy book, of truth alone. Not to be learned but lived, truth in its hour, to sprout within the heart's dark wintry earth, and grow a vibrant thing, then come to power, to slay the seeming self that gave it birth, or to devour. Heart of my heart, seen outwardly as one, in human form, to draw my human love, Lord Ramana Guru, the rising sun, self-manifest, the guide of all who rove, lost and alone. Entangled thoughts and vain imaginings, back to pure being, with your radiant smile, full of compassion for my wandering, tells me I always was, though lost this while, in a world of things.
In 1965, right?
No, we're in 66.